The K-12 Education Committee will come to order. We're going to start today with House File 1792, and I will take the testifier seat, and Representative Johnson will conduct the first part of the meeting.
Representative Segrin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1792 is establishing a request for proposal for establishing a value-added assessment system to go along with the No Child Left Behind regulations that we have to meet at the federal level. As you know, we've all had this discussion about our frustration with reporting academic results by school district and school site with different cohorts of children. And we have discussed for probably 3 or 4 years now the value or the better way of reporting by looking at a student's growth over time, that's a more fair way of reporting academic achievement. And it also gives us the ability to look at curriculum and data in a way that will help us become better instructors and better respond to school districts to children's needs. So that's basically it. I will have Ms. Pat Olson, who is in charge of the assessment process and technology in the department, to come up, and she can kind of give you a little bit more background if you request it. But basically, it is just establishing an RFP process. We're looking at about $250,000, and that would really get the RFP process going and then give the department an opportunity to kind of pilot or test, I guess, more test, do a test run on getting some data together from a few districts and just making sure that they've got the right data and that if they run into problems, they can correct them before we roll this out for the whole state in 06. Ms. Olson, if she
has. Thank you, Ms. Olson. If you could identify yourself for the record, and then please go ahead and give us your thoughts.
My name is Patricia Olson, and I am Assistant Commissioner of Accountability and Improvement for the Minnesota Department of Education.
Thank you. Please proceed.
The department supports implementing the value added. It gives us a new way of looking at the achievement of schools. Currently, there's quite a few different models out there, each having its own proponents. And we support the idea of doing a pilot test before we go statewide with this, to be sure that the procedures are in place and are psychometrically sound, and that any decisions we make will, be defensible.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Olson? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Olson, is there any language necessary to ensure that this contract follows state contracting guidelines? Do we need to add any language, or is that implied in the language?
Greg? Mr. Marcus?
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, that is implied in the language. However, if you'd like some clarification of that, we can speak to the attorneys at the department and get back to you on that issue, but it's inherent right now.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Marcus, you're more familiar with this than I am. Without any language which would exempt you from state contracting language, then I would assume that you must follow the current law. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, Mr. Chair. Representative Biskins.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Burnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill provides that the commissioner may contract with private organizations providing the service. Do you know of any organizations that are doing it right now, and who they are?
One.
Ms. Olson.
One. Very prominent one is the Saunders model. Saunders, I believe, is out of California. There's a couple other organizations that apply his methodologies. SAS is one out of North Carolina. And there are some more, and I am currently researching the different models and trying to get an idea of exactly what is out there.
Any other questions for Ms. Olson? All right, Representative Segrin, you had a list of testifiers as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we did. If those testifiers would like to come up.
All right, the first person on our list is Reg Allen from the department. Is Mr. Allen here? No. I'm sorry, Representative Heidgriffen, you had a question.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. A question I had on page one there, line 17-18. Program participants must represent urban, suburban, and rural geographic areas of the state. Are we going to have an equal factor here, Representative Segrin? Do you know, or can somebody answer that?
I'm sorry.
When I look at the representing the urban, suburban, and rural geographic areas, it doesn't say that it's going to be equal or anything like this sort. Are we going to get a kind of a equal representation on this,
Representative Segrin?
Mr. Chair and Representative Heidgriffen, I guess I would have to have Ms. Olson answer that question. I think the intent would be to try to, what we want to do is try to make sure that we identify any problems in the rural, suburban, urban areas in reporting systems, those kinds of things. But she can probably answer that better.
Ms. Olson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the goal would be to attempt to mirror the state demographics in proportion. That would be the soundest research methodology.
Okay, good. Thank you, because I see this as a an important piece of legislation that really would probably work all across the state, and
absolutely.
I want to see a fair. Okay, thank you.
Representative Biernat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for Representative Segrin. You're asking for $250,000. Does that mean this committee has a budget this year? Are we going to have some money?
Representative Segrin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Biernat, I hope we have a target and a budget. This is the figure that's plugged in right now, and we'll just have to wait to see what the governor's supplemental budget is. But this is the estimate that the department has given me.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Segrin, I'm wondering, I know it's a May here, but it says May contract with a private provider for the public school model. What is the array of providers that might do this? Could this be done by the University of Minnesota, or are there only private models, or why did we specify, a private contractor?
Representative Segrin.
Mr. Chair, that would probably be something you want to ask the department about that language.
Ms. Olson, did you hear the question? Mr. Marcus.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling. At this time, as Assistant Commissioner Olson indicated, we are doing some additional research on this. It's our understanding that the models that are available are private models at this time. But we continue to do research on that.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Greiling,
Mr. Marcus, Ms. Olson, there aren't any public models at all. I'm asking this because we just had all this outsourcing to India, and we have I know I have in my district people who are involved in technology and computers who are looking for work, who are very qualified, and I know we have the university over there. So I get concerned, when we are so concerned about jobs, when we immediately go to the private market in case there's anything public that's around. But so you're certain there's nothing public?
I am not certain at this time. The models that I am familiar with are all proprietary, and they only release so much information so that, they can keep the business to themselves. However, as the models become more accepted, I'm anticipating that the information will be disseminated so that a public entity could, and perhaps there is currently some of the methodology could be applied by other entities. And as my research continues, I'll be able to give you more information.
Well, Mr. Chair, final comment. I'm glad it's a May, but I would urge you to, look really hard for something public, because I think a lot of us have our antenna up about jobs being a concern. And so I would hope that we could provide the public jobs first, since we're trying to balance all this economy out and not lose workers.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding the assessment model that it's going to focus on the school and school district efforts on student achievement over timelines 22 and 20 through 25. After what we heard today from our researchers at the University of Minnesota, they really talked about the importance of getting data down to the student. And I love the value added. As a parent, that's what I want to know, with my child making at least yearly progress, if not better. And if they're not, then I need to know why. And what can we do as parents over the summer or during the school year? So is this going to get to data down to that level, not only for a parent, but for a teacher to be able to assess their students at the beginning of the year and at the end of the year? Because that's one question. And my second question is, have you talked with the school districts and teachers to find out if this data is really going to help them? Because it sounds like that's what we're doing it for. So who's been involved in finding out and knowing if this is going to help?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bernardi, currently the main goal of the value added is to identify how much contribution schools are making to student achievement, and it can be down to the teacher level. It's not a diagnostic tool for the individual students, but it can help us identify those instructional practices that are most effective. So we can disseminate that information throughout the state and help all teachers deliver better instruction for the students.
Representative Segrin.
I'm Mr. Chair, and Representative Bernardi. I think that the information from the MCAs will be drilled down to the teachers so that they will be, getting that reporting of how each one of their individual students. It will be individual student data, and it will be drilled down to the teacher. But for the intents of reporting or anything and looking at the system for No Child Left Behind, we want to move the feds away from these different cohorts and say a fair way of doing this is looking at growth in over time with school districts, school sites, and but that other information will be drilled down to the teacher, but it's not going to be the linkage there with at this time for that, except for their instructional purposes.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Bernard.
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair is testifying. This legislation doesn't do that? Does this legislation do that down to the student level? Like, I wasn't quite following it. Or is that the intent for it to eventually do that?
Representative Segrin.
Mr. Chair, the way I understand it, the MCA data will be reported to the site, to the school site, and the school site can, give that information to the teachers. And they will have individual student information, too, about how the kids do in the MCAs and the growth over time.
Mm-hmm.
That will all be there.
And will this value, Madam Chair, will this value added be a part of that? I mean, I know you're talking about the MCAs, but will this value added be drilled down that far?
Representative Segrin or Ms. Olson?
The MCAs will, as we incorporate all the grades, it'll be a constant system, grades 3 through 8 and a high school grade, and it will give information down to the student level and down to the different high-level standards. The MCA is part of the value-added system, but the value-added system can also look at other data and incorporate all of that data and the data over time to make further, to give us further information about the schools and the classroom. They'll look at the student achievement over time, and that may or may not be reported to the parents. It would depend how the system's designed. And that's another reason we really need to do a pilot to see, exactly what we get out of it and how sound it is to go down to that level.
It will be one. You're very gracious. This will be just my last one.
I'm a little more lenient than.
Okay, sorry.
Enjoy it while it lasts.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, will this data get to the school districts? Will it get to them in time? you know, I'd like to see it get to students by the end of the year so over the summer they can work on these skills, and then for certain get it before the school year starts so it can be used for student and teacher information. When will this data be getting to school districts and parents?
Ms. Olson?
That would all depend on when the test is administered. Right now we have set the last week in April and the first week in May for administering the MCAs. The school ends the first or second week of June, and to do this and get the data out that school year would be very improbable. It would be very risky. We'd be cutting quality procedures and risk errors in processing, which I don't think any of us want. It would certainly be available to the teachers for planning for the next year, their instruction, or we might make the decision in the future to move the testing window earlier, okay, so that information could be provided that school year.
All right, there are no other questions for Ms. Olson or Mr. Marcus. Thank you. We have a list of testifiers. If Jim Bartholomew would like to come up from the Business Partnership. And while you're coming up, I want to introduce a group of students in the back of the room, ninth graders from Southview Middle School in Edina. They're here participating in the Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government. So we appreciate you picking our committee. We're going to be on our best behavior today. And we hope you have a good day. Thank you. Mr. Bartholomew, would you please introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. My name is Jim Bartholomew, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Business Partnership. The partnership does support House File 1792, and if adopted, this legislation will allow the state to take the first steps in developing a value-added model for reporting student achievement. This will become even more important as Minnesota's accountability system matures, and by adding a value-added component that does not adjust student results based on demographic characteristics, we will be able to have a more accurate picture of how each grade or cohort is progressing academically over time. When combined with other assessment data, this will give us a more complete picture of how our students and schools are performing. The creation of this more comprehensive picture of student achievement will help parents and the public better understand how our students are doing, and as the author, Representative Segrin, mentioned, and equally as important, it will help educators more effectively identify successful practices. Again, I just thank you for the opportunity to be here, and we do support House File 1792.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. I didn't know you were at this apartment anymore. It's such a something, and I came back. And
that's why I came back.
You're back in your old place. I don't know a whole lot about this, and so there's something you said that just kind of triggered my curiosity. Without adjusting for demographic background, is that how this is going to work? And it's hard for me to think about how you develop good practices unless you're taking into account adjusting for a particular student's background. Maybe you can respond on that.
Can I jump in? I think, well, I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but we are going to be looking at different demographic backgrounds. And we will be tracking ELL students, that are free and reduced lunch, and, you know, the different minority groups. We will be doing that according to. So I don't know exactly what he meant by that, but we will be tracking them over time to see if they are progressing. That would not be, well, we couldn't do that under No Child Left Behind, but we will be looking at those factors, absolutely, and tracking them.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, that's not in the bill, any specification about that. That would be our preference. And what I meant by that is there are some models that do adjust student assessment results and report them, and in the process it adjust those results up or down based on their student demographics. So it kind of, it's an inherent part of the model to say that this type of student score should be adjusted one way or the other based on their demographic characteristics. And it would be our preference that those types of adjustments not be made, that the results would be taken in the context of the demographic characteristics of the school and students, but the actual scores not be adjusted based on that. So you're getting the picture of how the student is doing, and then you can have that broader contextual conversation, but you don't inherently adjust the scores based on who the student is.
Representative Marianne.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Reckon, so your concern has to do with the adjustment of scores. I think what Mr. Siebert is saying is that in terms of identifying practices, not only is NCLB required, that framework, but it's the intent that those factors be factored in the process of identifying. Because, it's sort of logical that there are, to me anyway, that there are, a diversity of practices that reflect the diversity of classroom or diverse school setting.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, I think, too, we have learned that kids learn in different ways, and even what one practice is in one area is not going to work for other groups of kids, and we've got to identify and start learning from those ways of reaching kids in a more effective manner. So I do want to point out, and Representative or Ms. Larson also wanted to let us know that in 120B31 statistical adjustments, there is some mention of that you have to acknowledge the impact of significant demographic factors such as residential instability, the number of single parent families, parents' level of education, and parents' income level when you're reporting that. You're not making adjustments necessarily, but you're reporting that these are the situations that are impacting some of this, the things that we're looking at, and organize and report the data so that local policymakers and state policymakers can, then make some decisions. So those things, those other additional things are supposed to be, data that is reported alongside of all of that.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Scott Kroonquist? Mr. Kroonquist, if you want to come forward. Representative Segrin, I don't think you moved your bill.
You want to do that? I would like to move House File 1792 to be considered for inclusion in the K-12 Education Omnibus Bill.
Thank you. Mr. Kroonquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and we are here today to support this bill. We have been working with Representative Segrin and many of you over the last several years to advocate for this type of policy and assessment practices in the state of Minnesota. And I'll be brief. I think the reasons have already been expressed, but it does, as Representative Bernardi pointed out, it allows you then to get down to the student level and allow you to differentiate instruction, isolate in on certain students to figure out why they're not making a year's worth of progress, on the other hand, those that are making more than a year's progress, then you could identify those best practices and implement them in other areas of the district. So in this era of the No Child Left Behind Act and accountability, we think it's very important to include this component. Just conversely, then, we can sometimes inappropriately end up identifying schools as failing or underperforming based on comparing cohorts from last year's third graders to this year's third graders, when maybe, in fact, that school is making significant progress with the students they have over the course of the year. And so we think that should be a factor in the report cards and the other reporting requirements. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. But again, we thank Representative Segrin for bringing this forward.
Any questions for Mr. Kroonquist? Okay, thank you. The next person on the list is Grace Schwab from the School Boards Association. Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Grace Schwab, and I am the chief lobbyist for the Minnesota School Boards Association. I want to thank committee members for considering this bill this morning. Once again, school board members are at their heart interested on student growth and student achievement. This bill would give us another tool in our toolbox to do that. We feel it's an objective means for evaluating new educational programs and curriculum, and it will drive improvement in the classroom.
We feel that the current snapshot of student progress does not adequately address the needs children have as we go forward. And with No Child Left Behind coming down, once again, this would give us an opportunity to even improve on the results we presently have. We are fully in support of this bill and thank Representative Segrin for bringing it forward.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Schwab.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next name on the list is Jan Allswager from Education Minnesota. Would you please introduce yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota. I think we would support many of the comments made earlier here today that value added really does provide more information to teachers and to districts in terms of where a child was and where a child is, has just arrived. And many educators see this as a technique that overcomes many of the problems associated with typical school evaluations. And we've talked about how with this year's third graders is different than next year's third graders, and this addresses that, and so that's very, very good. I'm going to ask you some thoughtful questions. I am not a testing expert. I am not a psychometrician. Our organization has been studying the issue of testing because, frankly, not a lot of people know about testing. And so if you ask me questions about testing, I'll probably have to defer them. I am going to start with the bill, though. On line 1.20, page 1, line 20, I did have the question about private versus public, so I'm not even going to address that anymore. I think you have thoroughly discussed that issue. I have a question about 1.23 and 1.24, where it says that over time for classroom settings where a single teacher teaches multiple subjects. And I'm wondering why, or we're wondering why, that particular model. To me, I would read that as being elementary only. And if that's the case, maybe somebody could articulate that. I'm not sure what the purpose is for that. That does lead one to think, what is the purpose of the test then? Is the purpose to narrow in on one teacher in an elementary building, or is it for other purposes? And I'll come back to that later. On lines 2.1 through 2.3 specifically, it says that the sources, even if the test data are not vertically scaled. And I don't know about you, but I'm not exactly sure what vertically scaled is. I had somebody explain it to me, and I'm still not 100% sure what it is. And so I ask this question because this is testing information that is going to impact our kids and be reported out. From what I understand, psychometricians say that tests should be vertically scaled. So why would it be that we would not have these tests vertically scaled? So it's something for you to consider. On line 2.5, the model must have the capacity to utilize each student's test data over grades and subject, no matter how sparse or complete, without resorting to imputation procedures. So the question is sparse. If you're in a rural district, are you going to get the data that you want if you have sparse information? And can you actually make accurate conclusions? I don't know. I don't have the answers to that. But should we be making big decisions if we don't have those answers? And then I'll just make some general comments. I think the testifiers in the Capitol conversation, or the participants in the Capitol conversation earlier this morning, made some very interesting points. They talked about, one of the individuals talked about large-scale tests or multiple-purpose tests. I find it very interesting that as a former teacher, I wish I would have had all the information that I'm starting to learn right now about testing. And that if you are going to test a particular item or a knowledge on one particular item or standard, you have to ask at least 5 to 10 questions on that standard. Otherwise, you're really not going to get data from which you can judge whether that student actually learned it. So depending on what your test looks like, you can only use that data for which it was built. In other words, if it's to look at the whole state, if it's to look at the whole district, to look at a building. The more specific it is, the more you can drive it down to the student, which is, I think, some of the questions that have been asked. And that information is very useful for our teachers to improve student data. Now, I think the people here today have been articulating the purpose of the test, and as I understand it, it's not to get right to changing instruction. The purpose of the test, I believe, is one, for OAYP, and then to make some decisions in the buildings about how we can improve instruction. One of the concerns that we have had is your test results are only going to be as good as the data that goes in. In other words, we would ask you to make sure that your tests are aligned to your standards so that you're testing the material that is being taught and that students are learning. If you have that alignment with the tests, then you will know whether or not they learned it. I kind of liken it to if you had a factory and you had an assembly line and you had a checklist to see if this assembly line was working. And then you developed a whole new assembly line and you used the same checklist. That's kind of what, when our old standards and our new, we had old standards and old tests and now we have new standards. We understand that the department is working on that issue, but my point is the data, the test must be aligned to the standards. And we would recommend that if you have not done so, to have some psychometricians take a look at this bill. I've thrown out a couple of things to consider. Have some psychometricians look at the bill and make sure that it is doing what you think that it's doing. Ask some tough questions. And I would just conclude with the aim of assessment should be to educate and improve student performance and not merely to audit it. By asking the tough questions, I think you'll get to what we all want, and that is to improve student performance and to give buildings, districts, teachers the information they need so that we can have effective instruction and improve student learning.
Thank you, Ms. Salzweiger. In regard to, we may want to have Ms. Olson come up. The first point that you made about the May has been covered. The language about a single teacher teaches multiple, that's language that was really pulled out of existing statute that was just combined into this bill. The vertically scaled test data that's not vertically scaled, I think it was looking at if we had some interim, I think originally we were going to try to do value assessment doing third, fifth, before the No Child Left Behind, and that there might be interim tests given by districts, say the Iowa, and we would try to maybe do some alignment, and that may be where that language is coming from. But Ms. Olson, maybe you want to talk about, I'm assuming that we will have everything aligned and vertically scaled and consistent, but you might want to talk about that particular language and why that's there.
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Segrin, I can't specifically say exactly what that language is here. That I've only been on the job for a month, but as a psychometrician, I am a trained psychometrician. My PhD is in psychometrics. And I do know that the value-added models, let me back up, the MCAs will be vertically scaled. As we get them online in around probably the spring 2006, the 2005, 2006 school year, we'll be able to vertically scale, so we'll have a smooth scale through the grades. Any psychometrician will tell you that the vertical scaling is good. It is required by the NCLB, but there are also some technical problems with the vertical scaling. And I think this language says that even if there are problems, or as we're developing it, this model, these data will still be accurate and usable.
It's not required that the vertical scaling be complete at the time we start using this.
And then
Jim Segrin.
The other question was in regard to how you would deal with rural districts that might have just, you know, some small data sets. I'm assuming that there would be some kind of way of combining that data to present valid. I don't know, how would that work with the question I think Ms. Allsweiger presented?
Ms. Olson.
I believe the reason for the sparse data are specifically addressed to the mobility issues of students moving in and out of districts, and they might be they're here for this test and not that test. The assumptions underlying this model, which
I see.
The assumptions are that you can have a missing cell or two of data and still get valid results.
That okay, we were looking at it in a different way. This
right.
is talking about if you have maybe an incomplete record of a
correct.
Student
yeah.
coming in at a X time and you have them for, you know, 6 months or you don't have all their
right.
Okay, so that there's some okay. There's some process in place to allow for that.
That is correct.
Okay. And in regard to the sparsity issue, I think No Child Left Behind's got a quite involved requirement for that. And do you want
to? Mr. Marcus?
This is Greg Marcus, Minnesota Department of Education, Mr. Chair. As far as No Child Left Behind is concerned, the data that is used for purposes of looking at schools for AYP purposes is only the data of students that have been enrolled in that school for a full academic year. So that is a little bit separate issue. The AYP model that we do have right now only looks at students that are in a school for a full academic year, or if a school has a number of sites within that district for a full academic year. So that is, I think, a little bit different issue, but that's how AYP treats that.
Thank you. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Segrin, I'm wondering if you wouldn't be amenable to tightening that language up. You know, to me, if you ended the sentence on the first two lines after test sources, it still doesn't say it has to be vertically scaled, but I think by adding that in there, even if the test data are not vertically scaled, is just like almost encouraging us to not have as accurate of testing. And so I would encourage you to just say the model must be able to accommodate a diversity of data coming from various test sources, period. And it wouldn't be quite such a red flag. It may be that in years to come or even later on in this session, we may find that we want to say that from various test sources that are vertically scaled. You know, that would be actually my preference. But I really object to adding it in there that we really, really, even if it's not vertically scaled, we're going to put this in statute, you know, which is there not just for this implementation stage, but forever. So I think that's way too big of a loophole for having valid comparisons. And then on the no matter how sparse or complete, you know, mobility has been my concern all along, and, you know, the answer to that is, well, we're not going to count them if they're not there for a full year, according to No Child Left Behind. And I still think we need to have mobility, you know, high up on our web page and everywhere so we can factor that in, because we, you know, just like with special ed students, we don't want to leave them out, and then people don't try to get them up to speed, but we want to factor in the mobility. It impacts the other students in the classroom. But if this section on line 5 does not even apply to that discussion at all, then I would, to me, that's something that we, again, like the other up there, is kind of a red flag to even put it in there.
Representative Segrin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Greiling, I think maybe we could clarify the not vertically scaled. I think what we may want to in the future also not only look at the MCAs, but we may want to look at other tests that districts are doing and make a more enriched report of what's going on in schools. And they may be doing the MCAs, but they may be doing the NALT, they may decide to do some other things. So you, they, and the NALT may not be vertically scored, or the Iowa Basics, they may be giving those at infrequent levels, but, you know, some, it, you know, to kind of do some, we always had the discussion about we went nationally normed. Well, some districts may decide that they still want to do a nationally normed test to make sure that you know, the MCA is kind of still jiving with what's going on nationally. So I think there could be some of that. It could be the interim. So I think I agree with you. We don't want to send the message that this is not vertically scaled, but maybe we can work on, I promise you, we'll try to work on some language on that. On the mobility issue, I think that the language actually is saying that we want to hold districts accountable for students that are mobile, whether they're in the district, you know, a year or 6 months or 3 months. So it's going to recognize whatever data, whatever information we have about a child, that we should use that and continue to, you know, hold our districts accountable in trying to make a process available for those students that's fair, and also fair for the school district too. But maybe Ms. Olson can clarify that. I may be interpreting it wrong.
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Segrin, Representative Garland, that's exactly right. We have certain requirements for NCLB that, and for our adequate yearly progress that we have to use, but it's limited. This is a richer environment, gives us better information for making local decisions, and, you know, there are differences locally. This will help not only the state and, you know, different regions to monitor, but even down to the district and schools, they'll be able to determine contributions of their local decisions to the children's achievement.
Representative Greiling, you follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Segrin, Ms. Johnson has suggested, which would make me more comfortable making this refer to the mobility, if that's indeed what we are referring to, on line 5, inserting after how sparse or incomplete, and then adding the data due to student mobility. And then we're clear that we're talking about student mobility and not just other students who have been there, but we don't somehow have it, it makes it more ironclad.
Mr. Chair, I was just thinking about, too, what if you had a student, though, whose some records are missing for some reason or other? It might be a student that is coming from another state. They're not necessarily that mobile profile that we're looking at that's moving every 3 months, but are we going to limit some of that adjustment or something, too?
Well,
Mr. Chair, I think we understand your concerns, and what I'd like to do is work with Ms. Olson and work on some language that would reflect what you want to do and what we're talking about, and then we'll come back and discuss the language again.
Representative Greiling?
Mr. Chair, Representative Segrin, that would be great. And I, you know, to me, when we're implementing it, I don't think it's as important to cover the waterfront as it might be when we fine-tune it later on when we notice these problems. But by overreaching, I think we raise concerns with some of these loopholes for those who are suspicious of what does this mean, you know, are we evaluating what, and so forth. And so if we could have, you know, pretty straightforward language, and then the things that fall through the cracks could be dealt with in other legislative sessions so we could more clearly move forward without paranoia.
Well, I hope, Mr. Chair, that people don't have paranoia about this. I think we've been talking about this for 3 or 4 years, and I think we've tried to have an honest discussion about it. I will work with Ms. Olson, and we'll get some language, and then we'll come back and review it again. Before we, you know, pass it, absolutely. So we may want to continue this. We'll bring it up in another hearing. This won't be done without further review.
Representative Greiling, can we wrap it up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lenient Chair, and this is my last question. I was going to be done. But as far as the concern that's out there, there is concern out there from teachers, and, you know, we heard this morning from the University of Minnesota people that we have such an attrition rate in our first couple of years with really good teachers who are not mentored properly due to a variety of reasons, who, you know, leave the field and so forth. And I have talked to many teachers. We all support this because we don't have to do it when we haven't been trained on how to use research-driven data and accommodate instruction accordingly for each individual student. But I think we do have to recognize that, you know, we have a lot of teachers who are trying really hard, trying to change what they're doing while the steamroller is moving along. And so I do think that we should take that into account and not have any little small things in here that have unintended consequences. So I'm very serious about the concern that's out there with teachers who think that in the newspaper is going to be published how much their kids learned, and that that will somehow impact impact their job, their salary, and impact if they even want to stay in teaching, you know, with that kind of situation, if it's not done fairly to take into account, you know, all the various criteria.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, my question is just going to deal with the concern brought up by Ms. Allswiger about psychometricians having looked at this piece of legislation, and I am glad to hear that Dr. Olson is a psychometrician, so that alleviates my concern a little bit. Mr. Chair, there was also Dr. Reg Allen was on the list to testify also. Is that not correct?
That's right.
Ms. Olson, is Dr. Allen also a psychometrician?
Ms. Olson.
Representative Perkins, yes, he is, and he's out of town, or he would be here. Mm-hmm. But he's actually doing a few studies currently, working with some of the local districts on value added.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Olson, Dr. Allen has also reviewed the language of this legislation. Is that not correct?
Ms. Olson.
I believe he has, but I will bring it to his attention when he returns tomorrow, just to be sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we need to keep moving. We have six more testifiers and another bill today. So, Charlie Kite, please.
And, Mr. Chair, Mr. Marcus would tell me that Mr. Allen did review the language.
He did. Thank you.
Yes, and signed off on it.
Mr. Kite?
Good morning, Chairman Johnson and members of the committee. I'm Charlie Kite. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, who represents school superintendents and most of the central office administrators in the state, the group that everybody loves. And with me today is Superintendent Connie Hayes from the La Crescent Hoka School District. MASA supports the concept of value-added testing and this particular bill. And value-added testing is an accepted methodology that many of our school districts are now using on their own, and have expressed to us that they would like to see the value-added concept built into our state testing regimen. At this point, I'd like to turn the floor over to Superintendent Connie Hayes. Connie?
Superintendent Hayes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Connie Hayes from La Crescent Hoka School District. The power of good tools. We put a hammer in the hands of a carpenter, but when we put a power hammer in the hands of a carpenter, he becomes a much better carpenter. Value-added testing is critical to good decision-making for students at the local level. On behalf of MASA and my colleagues around the state, we ask that a value-added component be included in MDE's request for proposals as they seek companies to develop the state MCAs. Today, we ask our teachers to develop educational treatment plans based on data on a different set of students than they have in their classes today. I've seen the power of putting good tools in the hands of teachers. When I came to La Crescent 5 years ago, we had lots of data on our math computation skills at the elementary school from the MCAs and the Iowa Basics, but our teachers weren't engaged. We talked about it a lot, but we never move forward with it. But our teachers are finding today that they can engage because, as Charlie said, we have put in our own value-added program. You probably know of a number of districts around the state. I think we're about 100 strong now who are giving the MAP test from Northwest Evaluation Association. This fall, we started that program in La Crescent. All of our students in grades 2 through 10 were tested on the math, reading, and writing portion of this test. How has that impacted work at La Crescent? I can tell you today that virtually every classroom teacher at our elementary school now has an improvement plan for improving computation skills. That's the power of value added. Add that to the accountability piece in La Crescent with our alternative compensation program, and I think we have our own little perfect storm developing in La Crescent. Value added makes a difference to teachers at the teacher level, and that's the power of value added. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Hayes.
We'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for either of the testifiers? Okay, thank you. And I counted wrong. It looks like our last testifier on this bill is Laura Boylone from the chamber. Ms. Boylone, could you introduce yourself, please?
Laura Boylone with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. The chamber supports this legislation. Our members have been concerned in the past about just looking at snapshots of classes rather than tracking individual class progress or individual student progress over time, and we think the value-added model has great potential for improving instruction. We also think there's a great advantage in using local assessments as well as the MCAs, which this language allows for, and we think an RFP approach is a great way to solicit the best ideas and models out there. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Boylone? I'm sorry, we do have one more testifier, Brene Hasmargen, sorry.
Mr. Chairman and members, good morning. Brene Hasmargen. I direct legislative action for the Minnesota Rural Education Association, and our organization simply wants to thank Representative Segrin for her leadership on this issue. I think you have single-handedly gotten Minnesota to a point where we will be a national leader on value-added instruction. And it is our number one platform priority this year in terms of improving instruction for our students. We think it will hold the system accountable rather than just the kids in that system. And finally, as we begin to shift from inputs to measuring outputs and rewarding and funding outputs, this will be the essential piece that we need. So we strongly support this bill.
Thank you. Representative Segrin, any final comments?
No, just to respond again to Representative Greiling, we will go back and we'll look at some language clarification. Mm-hmm. We'll work with Ms. Olson and some others, and then we'll come back another day to review that language for the committee before we move forward on it. And so I'm not sure when it would be scheduled, but it will be, you know, in the next probably 3 or 4 days.
Thank you. So Representative Segrin renews her motion to lay over House File 1792 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Before we move on to Representative Erickson's bill, in your packet, members, you have a brochure from the East Metro Integration District, and there were questions last week about their test scores and how they're doing on the MCAs with their unique integration model. And on the back of the page, you can see how their test scores have gone up over time in reading and math in grades 3 and 5, and then also you can look at the BST scores. And I did ask the superintendent about BST scores. It looked like they were maybe not quite as good, and he said they've actually, because they're growing their program and their grades, and so they have students right now that they probably only had for 1 or 2 years. They expect that their BST scores will be improving over time. But I wanted to give you that information. You can look through that. There's some good things in that. Then also we want to move the minutes of February 5th. And Representative Heidgerken, would you like to move the minutes?
I most certainly will. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And before we approve the minutes, are there any questions about the minutes? Are any corrections or additions? If not, all in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. The minutes are approved of February 5th. All right. Representative Erickson, do you want to present your bill?
Thank you, Chair Segrin and committee, and I'd like to move House File 1704 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Education Bill. House File 1704, everyone, is here because of equity needs. What happened in the 2001 property tax reform has had an effect on 23 of our school districts, and this bill will hopefully help these school districts make their repayments of their maximum effort loans at a rate that they can afford. So the thrust of the bill is to change the or to amend the rate that we passed in 2001, which was 32% of adjusted tax capacity, to 28% of adjusted net tax capacity. And I know that Chair Segrin is going to have House Research explain part of what has happened. And I have here with me Fred Nolan, the superintendent of Foley Public Schools, who has really spearheaded the movement for the 23 school districts to receive some equity in repayment of their maximum effort loans. So at this time, Madam Chair, I'll refer back to you in case you want an explanation, or would you like Superintendent Nolan.
Representative Erickson, I think before we get the testimony as to what the situation is now for those districts, I'd like for Mr. Strom to, for the benefit of the committee, just to kind of give us a little briefing on the maximum effort loan program, why the rate fluctuates from time to time, and then we'll have Mr. Crow talk a little bit about the impact on, you know, the financial aspects of this committee with that change. So, Mr. Strom, do you want to start?
Madam Chair, members, the Maximum Effort Capital Loan Program provides loans using state general obligation bonds to low property value school districts. The school districts receive the loan and then levy for a period of time up to 50 years to repay those loans. The rate that the district levies is set in law, and that's referred to the maximum effort tax rate. And prior to 2001, that rate was set at 24% for most school districts that currently have maximum effort capital loans. What happened in the 2001 session was that the tax committee proposed some fairly substantial changes to the tax base. Those changes were adopted by the legislature. And as a result, we compressed class rates and our property tax base statewide dropped by about 35%. We put a provision in the at the end of the tax committee conference committee, essentially a provision went in that bill that said any school finance rate that's specified as a tax rate, any revenue formula in the school finance area that's specified as a rate, should simply be increased proportionate to the drop in the tax base. As a result, the rate that was formerly 24% for the maximum effort folks went to 32%. That was the same increase statewide as the tax base declined statewide. However, the rates that were compressed primarily were commercial, industrial, and some other rates that didn't much affect the maximum effort loan districts. So those districts' tax bases went down considerably less than the 35% the state tax base went down. As a result, the maximum effort rate is higher than it would have been had we not made the tax changes in 2001. What this bill proposes to do is lower that rate back to 28%, which is about the rate it would be at if the tax base for the districts that receive maximum effort loans were aggregated and a change was shown between the tax base before and after the 2001 legislative actions. So the result essentially is for this one tax rate to align that more closely with the actual change in tax base that those districts faced.
Mr. Strom, so, you know, to just recap, the adjustment up to 32% was to continue having the districts make the same effort to pay off their loan. Well,
Madam Chair, we have a whole series of school finance formulas, a number of which are set as a rate. Mm-hmm. And so the provision in the tax bill said, well, we know the rates we're currently going to have will raise much less too much revenue statewide because mm-hmm. the base is dropping by about 35%. Mm-hmm. Most of the rates, however, affected districts across the state. And as Representative Erickson just said, this particular rate only affects 23 school districts. And their characteristics were very different mm-hmm. from the remaining 320-some school districts in the state. So the result of that change was if we had individually calculated wherever each of those rates were at and tried to have a hold harmless amount of revenue out mm-hmm. of them, this rate would have been more like 28% than 38%.
Okay. And Representative Biernack.
Thank you, Madam Chair, to Mr. Strom. I'm kind of trying to get the history of this thing because we've got a little handout, and it says originally this program was for rapidly growing suburban school districts, which on the back of the sheet, it doesn't look like any of these, maybe Farmington could be a rapidly growing, I didn't know Red Lake.
Big Lake
and so on. And so on. And so I guess I'm wondering how the schools fit into this in light of the fact that a couple of school districts here have ANTC, you know, well over $14 million. It seems like it's a combination of some low property districts, some suburban, and it's just a kind of a strange list.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Biernack, when the program was originally passed, it was authored by former Representative Popovich back in 1960, I believe 59 or 60. And at that time, the districts that were unable to build facilities tended to be the very fast-growing mm-hmm. suburban school districts. Over time, and particularly in the more recent history, even up through the 80s, in fact, many of the recipients of maximum effort loans were districts in the metropolitan area, fast-growing districts. And the whole goal behind the program for those districts was that because they were growing so fast and had relatively little commercial industrial property and only residential property, that the state would make them a loan of the general obligation bonds, and then they'd pay that back over time as their tax base improved and as their ratio of kids to residents in the district went down. And so what's happened is the list you have in front of you are the districts who have not paid off their capital loans, and many of the districts that received capital loans that were exurban or suburban districts have repaid those loans. But there's a number of districts who, even though they're growing, are very low property wealth and would not otherwise be able to afford the building, which is why the state still uses the maximum effort program. One final note there, that it is a loan, but there are a few districts where there's an expectation that the loan will never be repaid. For example, the Red Lake School District. There's no expectation that loan will be paid, but the way we do the calculations for that is we give them the loan, assume that it's a loan, and charge them interest for the amounts that they don't repay each year. But for most of the school districts, there's a 50-year window, and many of those districts will be repaying the loan over that 50-year time frame, but the question is how soon that will be repaid. And the higher that tax rate, the more the current residents in those districts pay, the quicker the loan would be repaid, the lower the tax rate, it would stretch out that time frame some.
All right, Mr. Crow, do you want to talk about what?
I got a question.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative. Boy, I'm telling you, you're going to really have me on your list. Representative Heidrich, I'm sorry.
Yes, I have a correction and a couple questions in regards to the movement. You had mentioned that some of the growth districts now are off and some of these districts are still on. What is the major reason for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Heidgerken, the main reason is growth in property tax base. Mm-hmm. There's one other thing that's happened. As I mentioned earlier, the maximum effort program started in 1960 or thereabouts, and it wasn't until 1993 that we had the debt equalization aid program.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a few districts now that are of relatively low value that it makes sense for them to refinance their bonds and use debt equalization aid instead of carrying a maximum effort capital loan. But for the majority of the very low-value districts, the maximum effort loan still provides a better financial vehicle for them than the enhanced debt equalization alone.
Okay, follow up.
Representative Hager.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you foresee more of these property, more coming on this list within the next couple of years, or do you think that some of the things that we did next year, the equalization factor, for example, in the budget we passed last year is going to help?
Madam Chair, Representative Hager, another change that was made at the same time in 2001 was an increase in the tax rate for those districts that received new maximum effort loans. And the goal there by the legislature was to force nearly all districts to use, from that point on, to use debt equalization aid. And so for a new district that receives a maximum effort loan, their repayment rate will actually be 40% of tax capacity. And there's literally only a handful of districts in the state that would be better off using that tax rate and receiving a maximum effort loan than continuing with the debt equalization alone. So in terms of this change would not affect future loan recipients. Any district, for instance, the Red Lake District was in the other day asking for an additional capital loan. They would go from the 32% rate to the 40% rate if they received a new maximum effort loan. But I think there'll be very few other districts that will use maximum effort loans from here on out because that rate at 40% is quite high.
Okay.
Representative Hager.
So I think I'm correct in that the only district I think I see on this list, Red Lake, I think is the only district that perhaps has growth because some of the things that we did last year with the Health and Human Services. I think that district is growing, but I don't see any other growth ones. But the question I have on there is on the other page you have my district having Osakis, and that is not my district or Dean Johnson's district. All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to call your attention to the fact that the fiscal note is included, I believe, in the member's packet, so that, you know, we can refer to that also.
Mr. Crow, Ms. Representative Bernardi, you had a question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, if this doesn't go through, I'm assuming your property taxes go up? And the other question I have is, what happened to your property taxes this last year in your communities? They go up a lot. Mine went up 20 and 30% in two of my communities. What happened to your communities? Do you know?
Fred Nolan, Superintendent Foley Public Schools. There are three things affecting your property taxes. The maximum effort capital loan rate and the growth in ANTC, which is also driven by the sales ratio. Let's talk about specifically this rate. In 2001, when, as Tim Strong correctly pointed out, you had tax compression and tax relief across the state of Minnesota, the auditor of Benton County started calling around and wondered why was Foley's property taxes going up when every other school district they were calculating was going down. And that's when they were informed of what happened as a result of the tax compression, that the rate went from 24% to 32%. Foley's ANTC did not go nearly that far up. And in fact, the letter you have in your brochure from Tim Strong in December of 2002 points out in his analysis the average went up 14 to 17%. So in that year, when everyone else saw tax relief, these 22 school districts now, Osakis has refinanced and they're out of the program, they're in the 50-year program, experienced an increase. They're also experiencing increases because of the growth in ANTC and the reduction of sales ratio, which is a different discussion. But if you look at the chart on the back, you'll see many districts over 2 years have experienced increases ranging all the way up to 70 or 80%, and the average increase among those three factors has been 44% over the last 3 years. And now I'd like to introduce the Superintendent Bertha Hewitt, who can speak specifically about Bertha Hewitt.
Chairperson Segrin and members of the committee, my name is Larry Werder. I am the Superintendent of Schools at Bertha Hewitt. Bertha is about 15 miles south of Wadena on Highway 71 to get you in the right part of the state. I wasn't at Bertha Hewitt in 1980 when they did get a capital loan. It's something I inherited and just kind of, oh, that's what it's all about, and added it to the levy every year and didn't pay much attention until the compression of the tax rates in 2000-2001 came about, and we noticed a major change in our tax rates and our levy. We're a very property-poor district in Bertha Hewitt. We don't have any lakeshore. Very, very few apartments, no large businesses, no large industry. We're mostly agricultural. So when the tax rates changed in 2001, our net tax capacity was just relatively unaffected. I think it went up, you know, went down about 3% in comparison to the rest of the state, which Kim alluded to, is about 35%. So when the new maximum effort rate changed from 24 to 32%, our taxpayers saw a tax increase on our capital loan of nearly 50% in the first year. In the second year, it was about 20%. And since that time, our increase has been nearly 100% of what we paid 4 or 5 years ago. We're the worst case scenario of all districts because we are the poorest in terms of per cap valuation per student. We would ask, I know our school board has talked about this many, many times, trying to look for a way to reduce our taxes because they are in the top 10% in the state, our rate, and we would appreciate anything that you could do to help us make this more fair. Thank you.
Madam Chair, before we go on, I want Mr. Crow to just talk about the fiscal implications for our committee and the fiscal note. So, Mr. Crow, would you just walk through that with us? And
Madam Chair and members, you have a fiscal note that looks like this. I'd like to refer you to the bottom of page 3 and the top of page 4, just to give you a summary of what happens. If you look at table 1, titled Impact of Reducing Max Effort Rate from 32 to 28%. Just for simplicity, let's look at fiscal year 2006. Because of the property tax and effective date in the bill, the first state general fund impact is in fiscal year 2006 for taxes payable in 2005. So in 2006, there are two ways, basically, that districts save or have levy reductions. And what happens with the maximum effort loan is that the loan rate, by going from 32 to 28%, the largest part of it is just simply that rate going down reduces the capital loan repayment formula. And that's what you see in the first line, part where it says Part 1 of Capital Loan Repayment Formula. There are two components. One is just the levy. So for 2006, the 28% levy that 4% reduction would reduce levies by $978,611 in districts. There's a second part that's not quite as easy to explain, but it involves the balances in these districts. Districts are required to over-levy to make sure that they have sufficient balances in their debt redemption funds to pay their obligations. Part of the maximum effort program requires taking those balances and using those to pay off their maximum effort loans. Basically, with the levies going down, the over-levy gets smaller and the debt redemption fund balances get smaller, and so less is levied there. So that's a small amount relative to Part 1. So that's $162,504. So the total levy reduction in an individual school district or in these individual school districts is $1,141,115. You see that on the top of page 4. At the same time, these maximum effort program payments are qualified for debt service equalization aid. So since the districts have less of those payments, they get less debt service aid to the tune of $537,177. So the net impact to an individual district in to these districts in 2006 is $603,903. Now on the state costs, you look on the last pair of columns. For 2006, the state is receiving $978,611 less of payments from those districts on their maximum effort loans. So there's a general, there's a an impact on the state's general fund because the state has to pay, make the payments on the general obligation bonds regardless of whether the districts are making their payments or not. And the same, and you see the same amount again, $162,504 that the state doesn't receive in part two. So the levy savings in the districts of $1.1 million also reflects a state cost of $1.1 million of additional payments, debt service payments that the state will have to make. At the same time, the state is saving in payments, in debt service equalization aid payments, $537,000. So the net cost to the general fund is about $600,000 for fiscal year 2006. So the way we would track this, if this bill was adopted, would be for fiscal year 2006, we would carry a general fund cost of $603,938 and a levy savings for fiscal 2006 of $1.141 million on our levy tracking sheets.
All right. Representative Sakura?
Madam Chair, my question does not relate to this. It was, well, it sort of does. What I was curious was if you gentlemen could, you know, you're talking about taxes going up or down 50% or 35%. Could you give me some sense of the amount of dollars that would mean to somebody? So if their taxes doubled or went up 50%, you know, what is, how many taxes in general are people paying? So what is the average person paying in taxes on their property? And so I can have some understanding of what we're talking about. Percents don't mean a lot unless you have some relationship to what it means.
Mr. Nolan?
Fred Nolan, Foley Schools. In the Foley School District, we looked at tax impact, okay? And I don't have the chart memorized. But this bill would make a difference for a $150,000 home of about $75 per year in tax relief. And that bill, I believe, was is a little over $600, like $603 in 32% of ANTC and drops to $528 in 28% of ANTC.
So if I understand you correctly, they were paying $600-something on a $150,000 house.
Correct, for debt service tax. Okay. That's not the full school tax, but that's the majority of it since the state took over the general ed formula in 2001.
And do you have an excess levy referendum?
No, we do not.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Representative Bernardi?
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. I just was, my question, too, was in your communities, the city taxes. I know you're not experts at that, but do you have a sense, did people's taxes go up because you lost local government aid? So is this like a double whammy on your school district? A lot of times when legislation gets passed, there's glitches or there's things that were overlooked, and I'm hoping I'm going to have request a hearing for my bill, and there was a glitch last year that Frilly School District lost about $70 per pupil that every other school district in the state gets because of the hold harmless clause. So I'm hoping we can fix some of these things. I just want to know the impact this is to your community. It might be impacting just the school district things, but you've also had have you also had major impacts to your city and county taxes in the last year from last year's tax or last year's decisions that were made?
Mr. Nolan?
Madam Chair, Representative, I can't say that's directly related, but we are property poor school districts, and we're in property poor cities and in property poor counties. And so therefore the tax rates to provide services in areas where there is not equalization are higher. And so in Benton County, Their tax rates are relatively higher, and the city of Foley, the tax rates are relatively higher as well. Of the seven surrounding school districts, we have the highest combined tax rate. I mean, we looked very carefully at that because we did try to pass a referendum, came very close this past fall. But when the voters said their taxes were high, we said, yes, they are. There are very few things we can do about it. We are trying at the legislature to reduce the debt service tax and spread the repayment out over time. And at some point, Madam Chair, I'd like to discuss that fiscal note and point out that you really have to look at a slightly longer time frame than 2 years to really see the impact on the state, because these are 30 to 50 year loans.
All right. Any other questions? Yes, we realize that the impact is over 30 or 50 years. We just, for our accounting purposes, we have to, you know, just, we've got tails out in the next biennium. Go ahead, make your comment.
Yes, I would like to point out that these loans, you have to look at each loan to see how much is going to be forgiven and how much is going to be repaid. In the case of Foley Public Schools, in the case of Bertha Hewitt, I don't know, Mr. Superintendent is going to have to talk about that, but in the case of Foley, it's very likely this loan is going to get repaid, and very little of it is going to be forgiven. But it's going to be repaid over a slightly longer period of time and not compressed. If nothing were done, this loan will be repaid by our current taxpayers in the next 8 years. And that's a very short time period to repay this loan. So it's, in a sense, a deferral issue as much as a forgiveness issue. You really have to look at each loan and sort of make some calculations and see what are the costs of this program for the state over time. But you're right, Madam Chair. You have a tail issue into the next biennium. Doesn't affect this biennium, but certainly does next biennium.
Okay. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, this is a question for you. Representative Biernat asked earlier when he saw the fiscal note on the previous one, if we have money to spend. I'm wondering, do we have a tails budget this year?
Representative Greiling, I don't know yet. I'm expecting that we will have one. I'm not sure. Didn't we have a tails budget last year? Yeah, we had a tails budget last year. So
Madam
I'm expecting that we would.
Could you share that with us as soon as you know? Because if that's a source of revenue, other people might have other bills to ask for those tails.
I would think that the direction might be going in the opposite way. Not more, but less. This does save us money, though, however, in the tails. So we will certainly be looking at all possibilities and looking under those cushions and the couches and everything else.
Madam Chair, I believe we have some testifiers from MSBA and probably MREA.
MSBA will be testifying, and are there others that would be testifying?
Sue would like to testify also, because the net result is that 16 of the top 35 school districts with debt. If you take the debt tax in the state of Minnesota and rank all the school districts from number one to the lowest, 16 of the top 35 are capital loan districts. So this affects them.
Welcome, Ms. Schwab.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Grace Schwab with the Minnesota School Boards Association. Our delegate assembly, which is how most of our legislative positions come forward in MSBA, spent some time with this issue and heard some very moving testimony in front of them. That these districts really do need that extra special help. So as an association, I had 150 school board members from across Minnesota adopt this as one of their legislative positions. So we are here in support of this bill, and we thank Representative Erickson for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Ms. Schwab. And Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell, Executive Director of Schools for Equity in Education. Several Schools for Equity in Education members are amongst the group that is affected by this legislation. We strongly support the legislation introduced by Representative Erickson. I think this is just another example of things that happen when you try to balance statewide policy on kind of programs that affect not all school districts equally. So I think that this is a very good piece of legislation, and we really think that it should move forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lundell. If there are no further questions, You, where is Representative? Oh, Representative Erickson, you moved this bill, correct? Okay. And it's before our committee for possible consideration.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I'll renew my motion.
All right. If there are no further questions, that will be the end of our meeting today. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.